Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm Doug Berkey, filling in for John Baum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage Podcast, we speak to leaders in DoD, industry, and subject matter experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So, if you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right space. To our regular listeners, thank you so much for coming back, and if it's your first time, we really appreciate you joining us. Now this week, it's time for the Rendezvous edition, our monthly installment where the Mitchell Institute team digs into stories you've been reading in the headlines. So this week, we've got General Dave Deptula.
Hey, good to be here, Doug.
Got Mark Gunzinger.
Hey, Doug.
Heather Penny.
Howdy.
Lucas Outen Reed is with us here, representing space as well.
Always got to represent space. Good to be here.
Okay, General Deptula, let's kick this off with you. Could you give us an update on your thoughts regarding events in Ukraine?
Yeah, Doug, you got a couple hours. I tell you what, as everyone here in listening to is aware, there's a lot to discuss in this regard. So let me offer a couple of big picture implications for U.S. strategy that really are not being discussed in the media space, as most of the current commentary is focused on tactical and operational level issues. And rightfully so, because people want to know what's actually going on the ground. But from a strategic perspective, what the Russian invasions unveil is that the capacity of the United States to deter conflict is significantly eroded over the past 30 years. And quite frankly, that's part of why Putin took the actions that he has. He sensed weakness on the part of the United States, and he took advantage of that weakness. Now, I tell you, sanctions didn't deter Putin, and they're not going to change his military calculus. Unity among European nations with relatively weak defenses didn't deter Putin either. It's only U.S. military strength that would have deterred his aggression, but we clearly don't have that capacity today. So I'd share with the audience that the Russian actions should be a wake-up call to rebuild the U.S. military. To put things in perspective, today we're half the strength that we were during Desert Storm, actually less than half the strength. And we've declined from the ability to fight two major regional conflicts at that time to only one today. So only by achieving the degree of strength necessary to defeat Chinese aggression in Asia and Russian aggression in Europe in simultaneous timeframes can we really deter either of these situations from occurring? And that should be the baseline of the new defense strategy that was just released. But unfortunately, that's not the case, as the Biden administration is simply not planning to program the funds necessary for such a strategy. And that takes us into a discussion of the newly released fiscal year 23 defense budget that we'll chat about later. Now, before I turn this over, let me hit another strategic element that's become evident since Russia invaded Ukraine. And that's Putin's rhetoric has done more to deter action by NATO to assist Ukraine than NATO's done to deter Putin. It's time for the U.S. to reverse this situation in a couple of ways. First, by supplementing NATO forces in Eastern European nations, and then providing the Ukrainians more and more capable tools that they need to fight and win. And here's why. It's because Putin's true goal is actually to restructure the security architecture of Eastern Europe. That's what he's attempting to do with his invasion of Ukraine. And he's not going to stop there. I'd tell you that a more forceful power projection by the United States and NATO in the days leading up to Putin's invasion could have prevented what's happening in Ukraine now. But that's water over the dam. Today, measures need to be taken to deter further Russian adventurism, particularly in the Baltics, which are susceptible to Russian aggression due to their proximity. And what would send a clear message to Putin to stay out is deploying units of F-22s to the Baltics and Romania. Then when the Russian Foreign Ministry makes another aggressive threat, units of F-35s could follow to Poland. And if any more threats emerge from Putin or his lackey Lavrov, then NATO stands up a no-fly zone over the Baltics. Then there's the option to send stealthy B-2s to England. Any one or all of these actions would stand to regain NATO's position in the deterrence equation. Meanwhile, the U.S. and NATO need to give Ukraine more powerful weaponry to take advantage of Putin's military disasters, specifically the means to empower them to annihilate Russian forces in Ukraine. The best thing we can do from a big picture perspective is to hammer Putin with existential consequences that will make him think of the cost-benefit calculus of his strategy and his ultimate goals. And that does include keeping the sanctions in effect for the long haul to collapse his economy. But in reality, Putin's a hard power realist. So we need to pull the levers tied to his ability to stay in power. In other words, what will make the Russian population question whether Putin's actions in Ukraine is worth their support? Hopefully, these are the kind of actions the president discussed with the other leaders of NATO last week. Collectively, they must reverse the deterrence equation that currently exists where Putin's in the driver's seat. But frankly, there's no evidence the self-imposed embargo of top-end weapons is going to end anytime soon.
Now, sir, appreciate it. Now, Heather, you recently released an op-ed regarding UAVs in Ukraine. What was your main line of argument?
Yeah, thanks, Doug. So, you know, to pull on what some of what General Deptula had said regarding more capable tools to Ukraine, UAVs need to be part of that, right? We've already seen how the Ukrainians have employed to incredible effect their little TB2s, the Turkish TB2s. Small UAV only carries two weapons, but they've been very successful in using that to stop and continue to target and also monitor Russian forces. The question I have is, why don't they have U.S. remotely piloted aircraft? When the Biden administration said that we'd be sending 100 UAVs over to Ukraine, they're sending over Switchblades. Those are loitering munitions. Those aren't remotely piloted aircraft, UAVs that you can use over and over and over again. So, you know, to me, that's the real issue. And the reason why is because of limitations that the U.S. administration has imposed upon ourselves. And this isn't just a Biden administration thing. This has gone back to the 1990s, where the State Department said remotely piloted aircraft, UAVs, are essentially cruise missiles or ICBMs that can be capable of delivering nuclear weapons or WMD. I think we've seen the way that we've employed RPAs like the Reapers and the Predators and Global Hawk over the last 20 years definitely proves that these are not something that we need to be concerned about regarding nuclear proliferation. And, you know, the other piece of it too, and we see this again with the Turkish TB2s in Ukraine, but also and significantly with the number of UAV systems that China is exporting to nations that we have denied their requests, is that this technology is proliferating. So if we want to really be able to continue to support our allies and partners, make sure that they've got the best equipment and that they're interoperable with the U.S., we need to change our definition of UAVs to recognize that that's exactly what they are. Unmanned aerial vehicles, they're aircraft, not cruise missiles. And we need to be able to support Ukraine right now with as many UAVs and RPAs as we can in order to be able to increase their effectiveness.
I appreciate that. Now, Gonzo, given the success we've seen the Ukrainians enjoy with their rudimentary air defense systems against Russian aircraft, what do you think it should tell us about the survivability of our older combat aircraft?
Yeah, great question. So Russia has suffered significant losses, including a number of their Su-25 close air support fighters and Su-34 fighter bombers. And most of those losses were inflicted by Ukraine's S-300s and much shorter range MANPADs are man-portable air defense missiles like the Stinger and Igla. So those losses really are due to a combination of outdated doctrine, inadequate equipment, and insufficient training. Let's remember, the Russian Air Force, Russia really looks at its air forces as an extension of its army. And they expect their fighters to act as extended-range artillery that can provide Russian ground forces with close air support. We learned the folly of doing that back in World War II. Also, Russia lacks true fifth-gen stealthy aircraft. So to avoid Ukraine's S-300s, their jets have to fly at lower altitudes, and that puts them within reach of Ukraine's MANPADs. And they also lack PGMs needed for all-weather, high-altitude precision attacks, so they need to rely on, you know, so-called dumb bombs which require their pilots to fly again at lower altitudes, which brings them within the lethal envelope of Ukraine's manpads. So to your question, what does that really mean for our old combat Air Force aircraft? Now, one emerging lesson is that 4th gen and even 4.5 gen fighters are not going to be survivable in modern battle spaces, even in fights against non-peer adversaries. Now, remember, Ukraine's S-300s are older Soviet-era models, not the kind of IADs that China has fielded, which are far more lethal. Another lesson is that flying at low altitudes to strike targets and provide close air support, like our A-10s were designed to do, is increasingly untenable. Let's not forget that Russia has lost more rotary wing assets than it has fixed wing fast jets. Yet, our Army continues to require a new attack reconnaissance helicopter to replace its Apaches and a new long-range assault aircraft to insert troops deep into future battle spaces. And those are exactly the kind of investments that DoD should reconsider, given what we are seeing today in Ukraine.
Any other thoughts from the group on this topic?
Yeah, Doug, great comments by Heather and Gonzo. Let me just kind of add that air power in the form of more effective UAVs like MQ-1s and MQ-9s that are obviously more capable than the Turkish TB-2s can provide assistance to the Ukrainians without incurring the kind of risks that concern NATO and U.S. leadership. And if we don't act now, the situation's only going to grow more desperate for millions of innocent men, women, and children, and more precarious for the free nations of Europe and beyond. So the question is, do we continue to turn a blind eye or do something worthy of our humanity?
Oh, very good point. Okay, we're going to switch gears here. The federal budget was sent over to the Hill this week, and if you read the headlines, you'd read about big defense plus-ups. And yet, when we actually looked at the details this week, it's really not that clear, especially when you layer the effect of inflation on this. McKinsey just came out with a report that if inflation hovers at 7% for the next couple of years, the Pentagon would lose about 20% of its current purchasing power. So they looked at this and said if this exists from 2021 to 2026, that would equate to $480 billion, which is the equivalent of 6,000 F-35s or 160,000 Patriot missiles. So I think the numbers we see in play are very, very difficult to calculate what they're ultimately going to get us. And so we need to really caution the challenges that we're going to face here, and especially look at fuel accounts and all that, what it's doing to the services. But big picture, let me do a rundown for folks. On the negative side, the Air Force is looking at cutting 150 tails that are on the ramp today. So that's 21 A-10s, 15 AWACS, 8 J-STARS, 33 F-22s, 50 T-1s, 13 KC-135s, and 10 C-130s. It's also looking at cutting the F-35 buy from what was previously planned of 48 per year down to 33. We're wrapping combat rescue helicopter buy at about 75 tails instead of the 113 planned. And we're also going to transfer 100 MQ-9s out of the Air Force inventory to another government agency. I think, you know, on the positive side, you've got 82 aircraft being purchased. However, losing 150, that's not the right side of the math ledger. The F-15EX was doubled from 12 to 24 airplanes. The remaining F-22s were slated for a series of upgrades. The KC-46 buy was boosted up to 15 airplanes, up from one bought last year. They're looking at potentially an E-7 for the AWACS backfill. Some plus-ups in munitions. There was a boost to B-21 and GBSD, so for the nuclear triad, it's very important. Space got some plus-ups. We'll talk about that later. Having reviewed those numbers, General Deptula, I really want to cut to the fighters first. That's been gathering headlines a lot. The cuts to the F-35 and the F-22 are obviously very controversial. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, Doug, let's put these disastrous cuts in context. Frankly, that's the only way I can describe them. Speaking to a joint session at Congress just a couple weeks ago on March 16th, Ukrainian President Zelensky issued an emotional plea saying that I have a need. I need to protect our sky. And if you've seen the shocking images of wounded children, homes, apartments, and refugees under attack, they all further amplify the dire nature of his pronouncement. Yet on the very same day, news leaked regarding the Department of Defense's plan to slash F-35 procurement by one-third in the Biden administration's 2023 budget request. The incongruity of these two episodes is obvious. And why the administration and the Congress, well, yeah, we'll see what Congress has to say, but clearly the Congress is blind to this. But the F-35 embodies America's ability to secure the sky for decades into the future. Cutting its procurement and then retiring nearly 20% of the world's most capable fighter, the F-22, instead of upgrading them, sends a signal to allies and enemies alike that America is failing to prepare for the very real threats that we're going to face sooner rather than later. So we need to reset U.S. air power capacity and capability. As a result of chronic underfunding, the Air Force is now the oldest, the smallest, and the least ready in its history, and that needs to change. The Department of the Air Force, now they do want to buy more F-35s, and it's doing the best it can to invest in modern aircraft. But the problem that they face is that they simply have not been given the budget allocation that's necessary to even maintain its average age of 30 years, average age of its aircraft. So to put this very simply, the Air Force needs to buy a minimum of 72 fighters a year to do that. But in this budget, they've only been allocated the money to buy 57. So the Air Force is going to continue to get older and smaller and less ready, quite frankly, because it's not going to have the tails to keep our air crew proficient as threats loom large on the horizon. Now, the issue is that the Department of Defense refused to sufficiently reallocate monies among the services according to need. The Air Force has been the least funded of all the service departments for the last 28 years in a row, receiving less money than the Army and the Navy in every one of those years. And guess what? With the release of the latest budget, it's now 29 years in a row. In addition, in the 20 years since 9/11, the Army received over $1 trillion more in funding than the Air Force. And that's an average of $53 billion a year more to the Army than the Air Force. Got it? The Army made up the preponderance of forces engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, and no one begrudges them that support. But guess what? We're no longer in Iraq or Afghanistan, and it's time that money be redistributed back to the Air Force to reconstitute its combat forces that were underfunded as a result.
Yeah, let me throw a comment in there. I agree with you, General Deptula, completely. We've heard the Air Force talk a lot about to get a fifth-gen force, we absolutely must have fifth-gen sensors and fifth-gen weapons, but you need fifth-gen combat aircraft too. And if you look at the trend, it's not good. In fiscal year 22, about 26.8% of our fighter force, including all Air Force fighter tails, are fifth-gen aircraft. And that's going to grow by 2% over the next year. And that is the kind of growth that's not going to give us a fifth-gen force anytime soon.
Well, and Gonzo, I would say that the reason why it's growing by 2%...
is this force is getting smaller.
Exactly. It's because we're getting smaller. This is a math thing. It's not that we're actually getting a significantly bigger, you know, percentage, realistically, of a fifth-gen capability. Right. We're just getting smaller.
Again, but as General Deptula said, it's because the Air Force doesn't have the top-line budget it needs.
Bingo.
Now, Gonzo, I get the impression that the Air Force and the Navy are facing some incredibly tough pressure trying to modernize their legs of the triad and paying for the conventional force upgrades at the same time. How do you read this?
Yep, you're on target, Doug. It's a tough challenge. The 23 budget is a good news and a bad news story with regard to the triad. Now, part of the good news is the nuclear posture review is done, And, like previous administrations, it validated the need to maintain a credible triad consisting of nuclear-capable bombers, land-based ICBMs, and, of course, the sea-launched ballistic missiles. So, consistent with that, the 23 budget has requested $34.4 billion for nuclear modernization. It plus-ups funding for the Air Force's ground-based strategic deterrent, which will replace Minuteman III. It funds the nuclear-capable B-21 and the long-range standoff weapon, or LRSO. It's also going to allow us to put those new weapons on B-52s so they can remain part of the triad. So there was a lot of speculation over the last year on the potential for the GBSD schedule, in particular, to slip. But the budget requests a plus up of about $1.1 billion from last year to keep it on track to reach IOC in 2029. It's the same is true for LRSO fueling. That's the good news. The bad news is DD has deferred modernizing triad weapon systems for so long, there's literally no room to delay their fielding. So it must modernize all three legs of the triad simultaneously, and that has created a huge procurement bow wave in the budget that crowds out other needed modernization programs. And the Air Force in particular, remember, has the challenge of modernizing two of the three legs of the triad, again, simultaneously. So saying that very plainly, after funding nuclear modernization, there's hardly anything left for the Air Force to allocate towards its other modernization requirements.
Now, Lucas, what are the highlights from the space budget?
Yeah, so I think the headline that grabbed most people's attention was that the Space Force received a significant boost. So just for context, the Space Force budget request was $24.5 billion, which is about a 40% increase from previous year's request. Now, that's a good news story, but I'd make two quick caveats to that good news story. The first, a significant portion of that is just rearranging the proverbial deck chairs in terms of how things are accounted for in the broader DoD budget, and so don't actually reflect real growth. And then second, I'd caution against focusing too much on the percent increase, just because of the relatively low baseline the Space Force was starting from. So for context, the Space Force budget is still less than half that of the Marine Corps, and still significantly smaller than the pass-through funding in the Air Force budget, much of which goes to fund space programs for the other various intel agencies. So it's about 60% the size of that pass-through budget, which seems disproportionately small, at least for me. But then in terms of the Space Force budget itself, I think the main takeaway is the continued emphasis on research and development, both in terms of budget share within the Space Force budget, and also where most of the significant plus-ups were relative to last year. So the RDT&E budget overall grew by about $4.5 billion relative to last year. And this year, the Space Force is spending more than four times as much on RDT&E as it is on procurement. In terms of what missions the Space Force seems to be prioritizing with that R&D money, the big plus-ups were for programs related to missile warning and missile tracking, and then also the NC3 mission, so specifically the Evolved Strategic SATCOM program, which is sort of the follow-on for AEHF, but focused solely on the strategic mission and not the tactical protected comms that AEHF also provides now. So I think these investments are needed and they are good, but I'd say my concern is that it's still an open-ended question as to whether these will ultimately result in any actual capability, and particularly capabilities aligned with the Secretary's imperative for a resilient space order of battle. And this is particularly concerning given some public remarks that the FY23 budget may represent a high watermark in terms of defense spending.
I appreciate that. Now, Heather, what's your take regarding ending the CSAR HH-60 program early?
Well, I think it's disastrous. You know, rescue helicopter, doing the search and rescue mission to bring back downed airmen that are behind enemy lines, that's a moral imperative. If we're going to ask airmen to go into harm's way, then we need to be prepared to pick them back up and bring them back home in case something bad happens. And, you know, given the fact that we don't have a real fifth-generation force, we have to be prepared that that might happen a little bit more often. I mean, we're seeing in Ukraine the vulnerability of these older platforms. So, you know, I think it's a real problem that the Secretary is looking to end CSAR H860 recap at 75 and not at least completing out the full program of 113, because we know that the current fleet is already too small and working too hard. So that's an indication. That's one of those small fleet dynamics problems. So it needed to be bigger already. The fact that he's cutting it before they've completed the program of record, I think is a real problem. Now, I do take his comments, Secretary Kendall's comments, that we'll be doing search and rescue a little bit differently in the future, and I completely agree with that, but I don't think that justifies the smaller force.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to talk about the people tied to those airframes. I mean, if you look at the professionals on board those airframes and what they do, the level of training, et cetera, and they've been burned hard for the last couple decades as high demand, low density assets, and then to further cut it, it's a big problem. We see a similar thing too happening with JSTARS and AWACS cuts. I mean, it's all about the people. And in the Air Force, the platforms are fundamentally tied to the people, and in this case, air battle managers. And that intellectual competence is absolutely crucial, especially as you bridge to new concepts like Joint All-Domain Command Control and ABMS. These are the people that are going to be very, very crucial in that. And while it is encouraging that we're seeing things like the E-7 coming on board potentially as a gap filler, you're not going to see those on the ramp for years. And so what do these people do? And what signals does that send to the career field? So, no, it's a big challenge for sure.
Doug, absolutely. I think your point about the people is so crucial. The experience, the expertise, the insights, the way that they execute their missions, develop new tactics, techniques, and procedures and operational concepts, that's crucial. And as you mentioned, that we'll lose that not only in the rescue community, but also within the JSTARS and AWACS, which, by the way, have flown a bazillion missions outside the borders of Ukraine, doing things like air battle management and SIGINT and ISR and so forth. So capabilities that we are using tremendously right now in the real world, we're looking at divesting, and we really risk losing that kind of expertise.
Now, it reminds you of sunsetting the EF-111. The EW community is yet to recover. General Deptula, we always talk about the pass-through funding here in the budget. Do you think it's still a big deal when you look at this year's numbers? And, you know, I just want to remind folks, the pass-through is a portion of the Department of Air Force budget that it's bolted on, but it's for the intelligence community, and it doesn't benefit Air Force programs.
Yeah, Doug, you bet it's a big deal. If you take a quick look at the Department of Defense budget request for 23, you would think that the Air Force is the highest funded of all the services. But you'd be wrong. In fact, the Pentagon invests the least. Let me say that again. The Pentagon invests the least real service budget authority in the Air Force compared to the Army and the Navy as services. And here's why. The Air Force budget is burdened by over $40 billion in non-Air Force spending, over which the Secretary of the Air Force has absolutely no control. These funds, which account today in this budget request for about 24% of the total Air Force budget, go directly to other DoD agencies passing through the Air Force untouched. Now, this pass-through budget practice is the single biggest threat to the modernization of the Air Force. This decades-old pretense may have been justifiable at one time, but today, it simply creates the false impression of the public, the members of Congress, and even people on the third floor in the Pentagon that the Air Force is getting funds commensurate with the Army and the Navy departments, and it has not. And it has not for decades. Like I mentioned earlier, 29 years in a row now, the Air Force is getting less money than the Army and the Navy, and as a result, the Air Force is atrophied, significantly aged, and fallen to quantities less than are required to accomplish our nation's defense strategy. So just to put the impact of this pass-through in context, if you look past over the last three decades, some $750 billion buried in the Air Force budget has actually funded other defense agencies. So the Air Force now finds itself between a rock and a hard place. It's in desperate need to modernize and grow to meet the threats posed by China, Russia, and others, but it simply lacks sufficient funding to do so. And Air Force Chief Brown is clear about how high the stakes are right now. Unless something changes, he's stated, we're not going to be able to accomplish the Air Force's core missions in the future operating environment. Now think about that. It's not just about the Air Force. America's entire defense depends on dominance in the air. Just look at the real-world example of Ukraine. But we cannot be assured of that dominance in the future unless we change the way we invest right now. So the Department of Defense needs to end this pass-through nonsense ASAP and become transparent about how the Department of Defense actually spends our taxpayers' money.
Yeah, and to that point of transparency, if you looked at the first slide in the DoD budget briefing, they showed service shares with Air Force pass-through bolted on without that really being clear. You had to get to about slide 27 for it to be clear that it was broken out as a separate thing. But
right, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It is actually deception, and it should not be tolerated, and members of Congress need to correct this, even though they don't need to. This is simply a move that the DoD comptroller could make by just shifting the line to other DoD agencies. That's all they have to do.
Yeah. Hey, Gonzo, what are your thoughts on munitions in this budget?
My quick take. It's great to see the Air Force increase its JASSM and LRASM buys, since those weapons are designed for strikes into contested areas. And the LRASM will allow the Air Force to take advantage of its bombers, which have the range and payloads needed to launch devastating strikes on PLA Navy ships, including amphibs attempting an assault on Taiwan. That said, the Air Force is only going to buy 28 LRASM in fiscal year 23, which is really a drop in the bucket for what's needed. And while the Air Force says it will buy JASSM ERs at their maximum production rate, that's only 550 weapons in 23. So that serves to emphasize our industrial base doesn't have the production capacity needed to rapidly replenish our PGM stocks after fight, and much less surge in wartime. It's simply not enough. Now, we've published a number of analyses that have shown that the Air Force could run out of those kinds of preferred munitions in single-digit days or a little over a week in a high-end fight with China. Now, that would leave our air crews with the option of foregoing some strikes or using shorter-range direct attack weapons that would greatly increase their risk of being detected, tracked, and intercepted, just as we are seeing today with Russia in the skies over Ukraine. So I should also mention the Air Force budget increases hypersonic weapon development by about $138 million, primarily for the air-launched rapid response weapon, or Arrow, which will carry a hypersonic glide vehicle payload, and the hypersonic air-breathing weapon concept, or Hawk, which will be scramjet-powered. Secretary Kendall said he's taking a more cautious approach to developing hypersonic weapons, mainly because the Air Force's future munitions must be cost-effective. And a single Arrow could cost somewhere on the order of $8 to $10 million each, which means the Air Force really can't afford to buy them in large quantities. And a HACM could be much more affordable and not as large as Arrows, which can only be carried externally by fighters, which is why I'm far more optimistic about the HACM program.
Now, Heather, R&D got a boost this year. What are your thoughts on that? Good thing, bad thing?
Well, so I'm really happy that the Air Force is focusing on research and development. I mean, it is necessary to be able to develop those new capabilities for the future. But what concerns me is that we are spending more on R&D than we are on procurement. So if you look at just the Air Force wedge within the department, $33.4 billion on R&D versus $25.7 billion for procurement. So I think that's a little out of balance, because especially here in the 2020s, we know that there's going to be major bills to pay in the 2030s as we bring GBSD on board. We're buying B-21 at rate. We've got NGAD and a number of other programs that will be in their procurement phase. We're not buying the things that we should right now. And this gets to Gonza's point as well. Only $900 million within the procurement budget to be able to buy munitions, only 2.3 for missiles. So we're not building up our magazine. We're not building up the aircraft that we should while we can. So that's a concern that, you know, we've got R&D is imbalanced with procurement. Another important piece too here is that we should be focusing on those transformational capabilities, right? That's what the secretary is telling us. But if you actually take a look at how it's broken out, operational systems development, which is modernization, incremental capabilities adds for the weapon systems we do have, that by far is the biggest chunk of all of the Air Force R&D. So $12.3 billion out of the 33.4, that's disproportionate. That to me says we're not actually looking at those transformational capabilities.
Yeah, so we see this pattern, Heather, over and over and over again. We've seen it for decades. Air Force S&T funding reaches a new high. And, hey, next year, the year after, we're going to start buying. We're going to start procurement.
But that's a valley of death. We never get to the point where we transition the R&D into actual procurement.
And the next year rolls around, a new high for S&T, and we're not buying. And that's exactly what this budget is.
Yeah, we need to stop R&D from being the good idea fairies and actually get it to procurement programs.
Rubber on the ramp.
Yeah, and I'd say particularly as, you know, the time horizon of when something might actually kick off continues to become closer and closer now. I mean, we need to be buying things now.
Absolutely, Lucas. Good insight.
Good points. Okay, General Deptula, over to you to wrap this up. Thoughts?
Yeah, Doug, let me wrap this up by what I said earlier. The Russian invasion of Ukraine should be a wake-up call to rebuild the U.S. military. What the Russian invasion has unveiled is that the capacity of the United States to deter conflict has been lost over the past 30 years. It's time to get serious to regain both the capacity and capability of our military forces to meet the needs of what our defense strategy requires. Because today, we simply cannot meet those demands across the board, but particularly for our Air Force, that, let me remind our audience, is the oldest, the smallest, and the least ready in its history. We have to reverse that, not for the Air Force's sake, but for joint force operations' sake, as the Air Force and the Space Force together are indispensable for the conduct of any U.S. joint force operation. Unfortunately, the current budget doesn't do that. But hopefully Ukraine will be like a splash of cold water on the face of the administration and the Congress to get serious about rebuilding our military.
I appreciate that. And folks, that's all we have time for today, but I really appreciate you all being here.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks, Doug.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. And if you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Airspace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about the show or areas you'd like us to explore further. And as always, you can join in the conversation by following Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org.